We acknowledge the people of Ngāi-Tahu Iwi, of Te Wai Pōnamu, Aotearoa, who welcomed Alone Australia onto their land. And we acknowledge the Cammeraygal people as the traditional owners of the land we're recording on. We pay deepest respect to First Nations elders, past and present, and all First Nations people. Welcome to Alone Australia, the podcast. I'm Gina Chick from Season 1 of Alone Australia.
And I'm Darren Mara. On this podcast, we're watching the show with you week to week, and we're breaking down all the action.
And we're also going behind the scenes for stuff that you don't get to see on the telly. This week, we're going to chat with two of the participants later in this episode, but there's so much to discuss about Episode 4, and I'm so excited.
I can't wait.
Woohoo!
So episode 4 kind of felt like a bit of a transition episode for me. You got this cohort of participants who were there for about a week, and then they got to that hump and that was their experience over. And then a bunch of participants who are, they seem to be setting themselves up for the long haul. In this episode, we saw Jason and Chase both tap out. I got to say, I thought Chase was going to go deep in the show. I was sad to see him go, but neither really made excuses, and they were both humble in defeat, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. One of the things that I really love about all of the Alone series is that it doesn't seem to matter what stories people come in with. By the time they leave, those stories have been broken apart by nature. And one of the beautiful things that I love is the humility that people show as they move and wrap up their experience and kind of pick it apart for lessons. I think that Jason was just like beautiful with the way he was so humble and really was metabolizing those lessons. And I guess, you know, with Chase, I mean, the poor bugger, he just found out he's going to be a dad for the first time and he's counting down the weeks in his head. There's so much there. Like, you're a pretty new dad. What would that have been like for you, do you reckon?
Oh, it would have been an incredibly difficult decision to make to go in the first place. Our son is two, and I was stuck in COVID lockdown overseas on Dateline deployment when my partner was heavily pregnant, and there was a small window there where I was almost going to miss the birth of our son, and it would have torn my heart apart, you know. So Chase, I can see, you know, when they passed that date milestone for finding out the gender of the baby, you can see how much that was playing on his mind. Mm. I've got 100% sympathy for his decision. I mean, it's that situation where there's almost no wrong decision. You stay and you fight it out or you go home. And I think, you know, he's just followed his heart.
Yeah. And I'd just like to say, echo that there's no wrong decision, because really with Alone, for us watching, we can think it's about how long you can last. But when you're out there, the experience just becomes such a personal journey that it can totally stop being about whether you win the money, whether there's a prize, how long everybody else is out there. It's what am I learning out here, and when does the timer go off for me to know that that lesson is done? Mm. And now I think we're really starting to see that. And I think it's important to look at it through that lens, because it means that we can view everybody with just a little bit more compassion when they're making those choices that from our armchair in our very comfortable house, eating all of our calories, all warm from our bath. It's so hard to understand what people are going through out there.
Also, time passes differently in audience land compared to the participants. You know, I mean, I doubt there'd be many people out there who've spent real time on their own like the participants are doing right now.
I'd say mostly haven't. In the chats and the forums after Alone Australia Series 1, there were a lot of people who had opinions. had opinions. But when they drill deeper, it turns out that some of them had spent a weekend away or, you know, 2 or 3 days or 3 hours. But to really go out completely solo, you know, it's all one thing to go out camping for a weekend, but to go out completely solo, knowing that you're hundreds of kilometres from rescue if something goes wrong, and you don't have your phone, you don't have your laptop, you don't have your Netflix, you don't have your nice comfy, you know, your coffee maker, you don't have any of those things, there's nothing left to distract us from what's going on inside. And if we haven't spent time on our own feeling those feelings, then when they come up, it's like meeting all of your own personal boogie monsters.
Mate, I can't go 3 days without sushi. Speaking of fish, though, and I didn't intend that segue, but speaking of fish, Rick seems to be going pretty well. He's caught himself a fish. He's got his shelter sorted. He's got his fire sorted. He's got his water source sorted. Do you reckon he's in a pretty good place?
Yeah, Rick's definitely got this beautiful, calm, measured attitude. And you can see he's got a lot of experience and I can tell that he's spent time on his own. This isn't a new...
He's seasoned,
yeah.
Mm. Tamika, she had a bit of luck with a Mamaku fern, or did she? 20 calories per 100 grams was the juice worth the squeeze?
Yeah. Well, in those situations, any calories are a win, you know. Even if it costs more calories to get that, what it does for our state of mind is so huge. And to have something that you can chew and swallow that your belly doesn't reject, it's like cheering hallelujah. To give a bit of context, basically what she ate would be maybe like the calories of an apple.
Oh, right. Not much at all.
Nah. But for state of mind, an amazing thing. Watching that, I was thinking that if Susan could have found one of them and eaten it, it would have done absolute wonders for her poor belly after her days of gastro.
So for Tamika, more of a psychological win than a physical win.
Yeah, but also just to have any calories in makes a difference to mitigate the fasting side effects.
Sure. Also, watching Tamika in this episode, it gave us a bit of an insight into some of the challenges that women are facing in this show.
Yeah. It's not spoken about much, but how do we bleed out there? Like, what do we do? And there are different ways to manage that. But when women are on their cycle, there's hormonal changes, there's emotional changes, there's calorific needs, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on with that. So to be bleeding and to be bleeding outside her cycle, that has an effect. Also, anything that's unusual that happens in our bodies out there is instantly a cause for alarm. It's like Mike going, oh my God, there's a pain in my chest. There's no one here. I can't get help. Is it a heart attack? You know, I'm bleeding and it's outside of my norm. Like, what's actually going on here? The part of us that's like a meerkat for safety is constantly scanning for, am I safe? Am I healthy? And anything that's a little bit of a twinge on that dial can send our kind of like our panic ratcheting up as well. Mm. Yeah.
I'm glad that was included in the episode, actually, because there'd be a lot of men out there who wouldn't even think of it, wouldn't occur to them that that would be a challenge.
Yeah.
Andreas. Wet and bothered and
poor,
damp.
Poor Andreas.
Yeah, episode 3, he was like, caught his possum, he was all good.
Yeah.
And episode 4, now he's like sideways rain, getting rained on. It seems like it's a bit of a mental and physical challenge for him right now.
Oh, look, it's a mental and physical challenge for all of them. That rain, that relentless grey sideways rain with no sunshine where everything is damp and everything is wet and it doesn't matter where you sit, your ass is going to get wet or your knees are going to get wet or you can't take your shoes off. You can't lie down anywhere because it's all wet. It's like a mosquito in a dark room going zzzz, just wet. Mm.
Inescapable.
Inescapable. So the poor bugger, I really feel for him. And it was really interesting to see that it was day 10 and it's their first day of actual proper sunshine in 10 days. So that's a long time to be in the grey.
Mm. He set his trail cam up 45 minutes walk from his shelter. Is that a good move?
Probably. I mean, the man's a hunter. You know, he does it for real, not just as a hobby. Like, it's part of who he is. So if he's setting up a trail cam 45 minutes away, I would suspect it's so that the deer that he's looking for, they're not going to get spooked by his movements, by his sounds, by his smell. It's far enough away that his actions aren't going to send those ripples out into the landscape. And the deer are going to be like, oh yeah, there's no one else here, so they can just hang around and do their thing. And you see him like sneaking up really quietly to then get barked at by that deer. So beautiful that got caught. The deer's like, what is here? Who is here? So he knows he's in a game zone.
Yeah. Let's talk shelter.
Mm.
So Andreas started a new shelter, Tamika started a new shelter, and Susan is considering a new shelter. What actually makes a good shelter?
Oh, well, conservation of energy is, for me, the number one law of survival. And conservation of heat is necessary for conservation of energy. So on one level, on a purely practical level, you want to keep as much heat in so that you don't have to generate heat yourself either through a fire or clothes or shivering or whatever it is. So you want to be able to enclose somehow a space so that the air can heat up. But you also want to be able to keep the wind from coming through for the same reason. You want to be able to have a fire inside that doesn't smoke you out. So this is why you end up with, a, you know, Tamika with her fireplace.
And that looked really nifty.
Yeah, yeah. She's doing a good job there. Lots of calories, though, to lug all of those stones to make that fireplace to keep her warm. So there's always that balance. But the other thing about a shelter is it's a home. It's a home. And think about it. Like, one of the most stressful things that we can do as humans is moving house. Why is that? It's because we are designed to know that we need shelter. In the traditions that I'm trained in, the order of survival is shelter, water, fire, food. We'll die fastest without shelter. Hypothermia will get us first. So it's like in the animal of our bodies and in our base brain, we're hardwired to think of shelter equaling safety. So if you all you've got is a flimsy tarp, sure, it might do the job, but there's a part of us that's going to be kind of like, oh, I'm a bit stressed, I'm a bit freaked out here. Whereas if you've got something that feels really safe and really beautiful, as we saw with Tamika when she made her incredible wizard house, then you saw she went, oh, I feel so much better now. I feel safe. She might not be any safer, but she feels safe. And that's a game changer out there.
Mm. Just quickly, Susan, considering moving.
Yeah.
Her current state, she's had diarrhea for a couple of days. She's probably in a weak state. What do you think about her decision-making at the moment?
Well, you can see that she is absolutely not just in starvation brain, but also in starvation plus diarrhea brain. Like, you know, like
that's a unique brain state.
That is a very unique brain state. Anyone who's been out on a bender and really done themselves a damage.
That's quite a bender.
Yeah. Would know that one. You can see just for her to get a hood on, you know, it's like, so I'm going to put my hat on, yes, you know, and decision fatigue is apparent across all the board with everybody at the moment. So for Susan, getting close to the water so that she can fish is actually logical. That makes sense. Having something where she doesn't have to walk a long distance to get water is logical. But the calories that it's going to take her to move her whole shelter at a time where she is now in starvation properly, that could be the end of it for her.
I guess we'll just have to wait till episode 5 to find out.
Yes, so.
Jason is a Yanyuwa Wanyi Garawa man from Gulf Country. He's also a youth worker. Jason, we've been watching you struggle through some long, hungry nights out in the wilderness before it just got too much for you in this episode. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. We're really keen, I guess, to understand why you initially wanted to come onto the show.
I think it was just something I thought I could do. I'd seen, obviously, season one with lovely Gina and the other amazing cast there. And I'd watched most of the US versions as well. And I just thought, oh, I could, you know, I've got a pretty unique kind of hunting skill set and I've spent a fair amount of time outdoors. And that's something I'd, yeah, be interested in giving a crack. So, yeah, I applied.
One of the things that I really love about Alone is that we see people meet their edges. We all do it. We all get humbled in the end. And our edges can be physical or they can be emotional or they can be mental. And what I really noticed with your journey was that you really ran into the physical when you were out there. You got smashed by the sandflies. You had physical symptoms. Can you talk us through a little bit, because I think people don't really understand what happens when we fast, how the fasting affected your body?
I was surprised how quick it happened. I thought, you know, again, having watched previous seasons, people can go quite a long time without food. I guess that I am quite a bigger build. Obviously, it happened a lot faster to me. You start to really feel your physical, you know, your cognition and your sort of motor skills start to dwindle around the day 5 mark, I would say, day 4, day 5. And then by the time we got to where I tapped out, I was not in a good way. I think it's almost like your thoughts and you're kind of separate from from your body in a weird way. It's like your brain sending messages to your body, but it's delayed. I played football professionally for quite a few years and had quite a few head knocks and concussions, and that's the closest thing I can attribute it to, is a really bad concussion. So, yeah, it did happen for me pretty quick. Those first few days, obviously, you're quite hungry, but you just deal with it. For me personally, once I got to about day, I think it was at the end of day four, and I was like, oh, wow, you know, I really feel tired and, like, everything's starting to ache and get heavy, and it was a fast decline.
And I think that describing that it's like having concussion, I feel quite similar about it, because our brains, they feed on glucose and glutamine, and when we're not getting either of those, it's like our brain just kind of switches off. So can you just sort of talk us through, you know, you ran into the physical challenges. I'm really curious to hear how then, on top of all of that, the sandflies factored in.
Yeah, the sandflies were really tough to deal with. I mean, something that I've really enjoyed about this season is in quite a few shots from different participants, you can just see them crawling over people's faces, across the lens of the camera. It really is like that. I think it's Jack who gets his legs quite badly peppered in episode 3. It's real, and they just do not stop. It doesn't matter if you're on the beach or if it's daylight or nighttime, or they're just everywhere. There's no escape from them.
Jason, do you feel like that combination of starvation brain and then the sand flies as well just completely hindered your decision-making abilities and your ability to start taking proactive steps to try and source food? Talk me through that process and how everything sort of coalesced to just make life impossible out there for you.
Yeah, it definitely does get to you. The sand flies are kind of, in a weird way, you do kind of get used to them after a few days. You just kind of accept that you're going to be itchy and that they're going to be crawling on you. You know, when I tapped out, they're literally crawling across my eyes and I'm not even reacting, which is just weird. Like you said, everything kind of factors in to your ability to be able to hunt and to be able to procure food or keep warm and basic things like that. It's really interesting how quickly your decision-making ability just dwindles as well. Like when you've got no food in the belly and you're sleeping pretty rough and all those things, they all compound and you do kind of get to this point where you're like, oh, what do I do? Like, do I go for that walk along the beach or do I go to get firewood or do I concentrate on fishing? I think it was Susan that sort of articulated that in last night's episode. She's like, oh, you know, just racked by indecision or something to that effect. And that was something I could definitely relate to. You just get into this fog where you don't really know what you're doing, what you should be doing, what you should be concentrating your energy on, if you should be conserving energy or expending it. It definitely catches up.
We have a listener question which touches on this a little bit. This is from Jen, and she wanted to know, she says, I was interested in the metabolic effects of the rapid weight gain and starvation. Does it mess you up for a while after? I've heard that dieting can permanently lower your metabolic rate, so I wonder what weeks of starvation does when you're back in the land of easy food, and what about the weight gain? How does that resonate with your experience?
When you go back into the real world, you definitely have to moderate and monitor what you put into your body. I don't think I was allowed to have a lot of carbs for a long time just because of that. You know, your body's in ketosis and you can get something called refeeding syndrome, I think it's called. I don't know exactly what happens, but from what I understand, it's if your body has this kind of influx of carbohydrates and heavier foods that it's just not able to process, I guess. And yeah, that can lead to all sorts of nasty things like liver failure and other things to that nature.
And then in the aftermath, of course, not being able to go into specifics, but how did your body recover?
It took a while. I think the first couple of days after coming out, I just slept. I couldn't get out of bed. I was just absolutely dog bone tired. And then, you know, try to do a few little things like some light walks and, you know, very, very, very mild exercise in the form of walking. And I was just absolutely tanked from walking a few hundred meters or something like that. So that definitely took a long time to get over. And just something that I really noticed last night and when I did tap out was my speech was really slurred and really delayed. That took a lot longer than I would have thought to recover as well. I was seeing a doctor and he asked me a really simple question like, oh, what's your name and your date of birth? And I literally had to like sit there for a couple of seconds and like think about it. And the best way I can describe it is that like it was like I was in the room and I was having to talk to myself through it. I was having to say like, hey, the doctor asked you a question. When's your birthday? As weird as that sounds, it was literally like my mind was disconnected from my body and I had to kind of give myself a little nudge to say, hey, he's asking you a question. When's your birthday? So, yeah, that was weird.
On Alone, we get to see a very small part of participants' backstory, that, and yours is really fascinating. You're an awesome hunter, and it's sad, I think, that we didn't get to see your hunting skills, but I'd love to sort of, like, find out a little bit more of, like, how you came originally to hunting. What was it like when you very first discovered hunting, and how did that happen?
My very earliest memory is being with mum and dad gutting this big wild pig. Mum and dad used to make a side living hunting for pig and fox pelts and different things like that back in the early 80s. And literally my first memory is of dad gutting this big pig, and like the smell of pig guts is quite a particular strong smell for people that have experienced it. Yeah, so I started hunting with dad pretty much from when I could walk. We were out doing stuff. I think I shot my first rabbit when I was like 5, maybe. Yeah, there's a photo of me at home somewhere with it. This little rabbit with my open sight 22. So yeah, I've literally been doing it most of my life. And yeah, in those early years, it was with dad. We did a lot of hunting with rifles, and I did learn to use a recurve bow when I was probably 11 or 12, I guess. And then I think it was 2015 when I reconnected with mum up in the territory, and yeah, got to go out on country out in Borroloola and out in Yunyuwa country and hunt with family up there using sort of more traditional methods, harpoons and hand spears and different things like that. It is a pretty broad skill set that I have. And yeah, it is a shame that I didn't get to showcase too much of it, but you know, that's the way it went and I've got no regrets.
It's lovely to hear, and it was really obvious as well as you left the show, your humility. And I don't know if that's because of the time that you've spent, you know, you've come from your, like, the white fella hunting, and then you've got your traditional indigenous hunting and time on the land, and it seems to have all combined. It feels like you've got a deep connection to relationship, not just with the land, but, you know, with yourself enough to be able to kind of like metabolize these experiences.
Yeah, I do feel very lucky that I've got both sides of the coin, so to speak. And yeah, I think when mum and I did reconnect, it was just a really good time in both our lives. I think we'd been away from each other for 14 or 15 years or something like that at that point. And I think it was really good for both of us to sort of heal and forgive one another and put past in the past and build our relationship from new, if that makes sense. So I do feel incredibly lucky every time I go out to Borroloola and to back out on Yunyuwa country. It's a really unique feeling, but it's the best way I can describe it is like, it's like there's a big blanket that gets wrapped around you when you get out there and you just feel like you're a part of the place and that you're connected to it. And especially when you go out, you know, fishing or just out on country somewhere with family, it's, yeah, there's nothing else quite like it. So I'm very lucky.
Since discovering, you know, your mum in such extraordinary circumstances and then being welcomed into your mob and your homelands, do you understand your own humanity differently as a result of that?
Oh, definitely. And I think that reconnecting with her and reconnecting with family definitely, I guess, shone a light on myself and my mum in a strange way. I think it helped me understand both of us better. We definitely, I think, understand each other a lot more because of that time, for sure.
Jason, just quickly, has your life changed a lot since Alone?
in the last couple of months, I would say it has, just obviously people knowing that I was on the show and, you know, there's a real buzz around town and particularly around work and friends and family and stuff like that. So I think I've had this feeling the whole time since doing the show that the end of the show won't be the end of the experience. I know that's a weird thing to say, but I feel like there'll be other things that kind of pop up down the line. I don't know what they are yet, but, you know, that's the beauty of life. We don't really know what's around the corner.
Well, I can tell you what is around the corner. It's our lightning round. So this is basically 10 quickfire questions where we'll throw them at you, and if you can just answer as quickly as you can, Jason, and we'll kind of rocket through them. And the first question is, what was the favourite of your 10 items?
Leatherman.
What was your biggest surprise out there?
Biggest surprise was the weather.
Who or what did you miss most?
I definitely missed Hannah, my wife, the most.
Oh.
Yeah.
What was your favourite pastime when you were out there?
Favourite pastime? Oh.
If any.
That's a tough one.
Remaining sane.
Probably just like getting a fire going. I think that's really good, you know, everyday kind of, you know, it's getting that fire going in that climate was a big win to begin with. I wasn't even sure if I'd be able to do it. So getting that, you know, and boiling up some water, and that was my biggest one.
For the last 4 days, I've had, for no reason whatsoever, I've had the song Waterloo stuck in my head. When you were out there, did you have a song stuck in your head?
No, I didn't, weirdly. No, not that I can remember.
Is there anything that you'd tell anyone, just quickly, applying for a loan?
I would say definitely do it. It's a great experience and you learn so much about yourself. You learn a whole new skill set in being able to, you know, document your journey, and you meet incredible people. So do it 100,000%.
Sandflies or leeches?
Leeches.
Would you do it again?
Yes.
One thing that you'd do differently?
I don't know that I would do anything differently, honestly. I think, I gave it my best with the tools and the information that I had, so I don't know that I would change anything.
One lesson that you learnt out there?
Probably the biggest one for me was just the importance of human connection, just seeing people through the day. You know, driving past people in traffic and, you know, getting your morning coffee or filling up your car at the servo, those like really seemingly meaningless interactions are really, you know, you really notice when you don't have those every day. Yeah, especially for someone like me who's not particularly outward or social. Normally I don't mind being on my own, but you definitely notice when you're not talking to people at all. Even if it's something as simple as saying good morning to someone that you walk past when you're, you know, on the way to work or something. So, yeah, definitely those little 1% social interactions that you have every day, really value those now.
So thank you so much for coming into chat with us. I feel like we could talk all day.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been great getting to know you over the last month on TV, Jason. So, and thanks so much for making the time to talk to us. It's been great.
No worries. Thank you both.
So up next, we're chatting with Quandamooka man and Defence Force combat engineer Chase. He was some viewers' early favourite to take the show, also the youngest participant in a show. I must confess, Chase, you were my early favourite to take the show as well. You're a skilled hunter, quick to find food to forage, but few people could fault your reasons for wanting to tap out. Firstly, I wanted to ask, how is your partner and your child?
Oh, yeah, amazing. Young Scardy's nice and fat and healthy and fine in her eyes, and yeah, things are going swell.
That's great to hear, mate. I'm a father. I have a two-year-old son. And when my partner was 7 months pregnant, I was sent on foreign deployment to Europe. And I got stuck over there while the pandemic was happening. I got stuck in hotel quarantine. And I was trying everything I possibly could to get back to Australia. And I had all this angst and anxiety about missing out on these important moments. I was a first-time father. So I kind of resonated quite a lot with what you were going through out there on the show. I was hoping you could sort of take us back to those moments and give us an insight into what was going through your mind as you were coming into the show, about to be dropped off, knowing what was going on back home.
Well, I feel like I had drop shock before I even got on the show, for say, because a week before we were scheduled to leave is when we got the news, right? So it was pretty intense, but I feel like I didn't quite process that to begin with. And in a young man's mind, it was just stay the course, son, and what you're doing is the right thing for the money and rah rah, and you know, for your legacy, and you'll be able to show your children what a strong man looks like. And you know, I sort of overlooked things like how much stress my partner was under at the time, and how sick she was, and how much help she needed. And those things start looping on you once you're out there alone. So I made up my mind that I'd get to 10 days before I made that decision. But yeah, once I made that 10th day and nothing really changed in my mind, I thought, I think it's time to go home, and I think people at home need me. That's how that decision came about, yeah.
Beautiful. And, you know, having been a pregnant mother, I've got to say that I was so cheering, as I suspect many have been and were, to really feel you in that process. Because the thing about pregnancy is, as a woman, we get to feel like the reality of, oh my goodness, this is a child. There is something physically happening to my body and it's undeniable. But when you're on the outside as a father, it's like, well, yes, there's a pregnancy and it's happening, but that reality doesn't, in my experience and with my friends, really kick in until there's a baby. Yeah. So it's a completely different decision-making process. Do you relate to that?
Absolutely, I relate to that. And that was a massive revelation for myself when I was out there just going, damn, I am going to be a father. Like, holy moly, what the hell's just happened to my life? Also, an incredibly humbling thing too, because, you know, I'm very happy about it. And the love I have for Scardy is just something I was never prepared for it and did not understand that that's how it was going to be. And Christ, now, you know, you do the baby voice and you're like, what the hell? Who am I? Like, so, yeah, things changed.
And you mentioned that you were, you know, your initial motivation was to go out there and, yes, I'll stay the course and I'll show my child what a strong man looks like. Mm. Has that idea changed for you since participating on Alone Australia and since having a baby to hold?
Well, yeah, it has, because now the most important thing is being there for the child and your family. Family's always been a massive thing for me throughout my entire life, and because I am the family member that people call when any of them need help, and even if they're distant cousins, because they know I'll come always, and no matter what the circumstances are. And but now you've got a daughter there as well. You, my life's secondary. Because her life's now primary, yeah.
When were you able to tell the producers of the show what was actually going on in your life?
Oh, I snuck one into one of the producers right before leaving. So I just sort of went, hey, this has happened to me. She was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, I bet. You must have had some anxieties around that.
Oh, well, yeah. I still, at the time, thought I was, you know, I was doing the right thing. I was doing the right thing for me anyway, because I got out there and proved to myself that I can do it. I've got the skills. I'm sharp enough to do it, absolutely. And, you know, 10 days was a good mark for me, thinking, well, once you've made that amount of time, you've proven you can do everything. And if you can do it well, that's good. That's even better.
You went in there as a hunter with a lot of physical skills. Were you at all surprised by the skills that you didn't know that you needed?
Oh, I think there's been a lot of emphasis on my hunting skills from the beginning, because obviously it's one of my strong suits. However, I'm still pretty damn good at the rest of it. So surprisingly, I suppose, because we're also in New Zealand, so it was just learning a whole new range of plants and faunas and things like that. That was something I had to cram into, because we didn't learn the location till very late. There wasn't much time to cram that one in. So, yeah. I could have been lacking definitely in regards to like medicinal purposes for plants, and that worried me too if I got out there and got an injury.
From what we've seen across the four episodes so far, you haven't seemed to have really struggled physically. Was that the case? I mean, were you getting hungry out there, or were you finding enough to keep yourself satiated?
No, I wasn't struggling physically at all. There was times where getting up them hills was tiring and stuff, and you're definitely not yourself at that stage because you are at a deficit, and those hills are brutal. But yeah, climbing hills is quite natural to me. I'm always out hunting, and we chuck the packs on, we go climbing up the hills the first thing we do. And yeah, I definitely felt a little bit weaker, but I was pretty good because I was, you know, grazing the whole time, and it wasn't too bad at all.
And also, you're the youngest one out there. You got to that, you know, youthful exuberance, and everything still works.
Absolutely.
unlike us old fellas.
you might have been older, but the knowledge of that age is worth tenfold.
What was it actually like hunting on that country in that terrain?
Oh, hectic. Yeah, it was the wettest place I've been on my life. Oh, my God. When I climbed that mountain, I got to the top where the trees were, but that was a slog the entire damn way because it was so wet. Every time you put your foot in somewhere, it turned into a cave you fell into, and then you tried to get over a tree and the bark crumbled away where it had been rotten underneath. So I was just slipping and sliding and falling. And then when I tried to get it to the snow line, when I got up there to the top of the damn mountain, you realize it's actually just cliff there, so it's hard to see from down the beach. But once you got up into the mountains, it was vertical. It was straight up and down. It was pretty crazy. Hunting there was very intense for the fact that it was really hard to stay quiet and move stealthily. Yeah, it was quite a challenge.
On the topic of hunting, Chase, we've got a listener question from Sambar, who says you were also his pick as favourite for the show. But he had a question about hunting. He says, why not build a tree stand to get high or out of the wind and wait for the deer over one of their trails?
Ambushing was obviously a good tactic that I was trying to get to, and I was doing a bit of exploring. I was trying to get the lay of the land. Absolutely, mate. That would be a great thing to do if you sort of know what the movements were. There was a specific type of tree that I kept finding in the area that was cropped up to about head height, so I knew the deer were coming in there and smashing that and up on their back legs, and so I'd have liked to set up on one of them. But you know, with a bit more time, I absolutely would have tried to employ some sort of ambush after I figured out where they were all coming around and what they were trying to eat and stuff, because they're all different there in New Zealand. I never hunted red over there at all. So I had to do a lot of learning too first before I went and started trying to ambush them. Yeah,
I heard a rumor that you're a bit of a wild child when you're a young'un. I was just wondering, were there any specific mentors that helped you turn that around? Have you got any stories from back in the day?
I can accredit one man for a lot of my turnaround in life, and he was my blacksmith teacher. And so at the time, I was homeless. I only had my ute and a box full of tools and my dog, and that was it. And I had a samurai sword at the time, and I got word that if there's an old fella up the road there who knows a lot about that sort of stuff. And here I was showing up on some fella's doorstep at 8 o'clock in the morning, knocked on the door. He had no idea I was coming. He came to the door in his pajamas and a cup of tea. And at the time, I didn't sort of realize it, but there's a fella standing on your doorstep with a sword. And he looked me up and down and just 10 seconds of awkward silence, you know. what do you want? I said, oh, I heard you know about this sort of stuff. And rah, rah, he just said, all right, come in then. And then so that was the start of it all. And I seen all these tools and stuff. He said, you like working with metal? And lit up the forge and he had me strike for him for a little bit. And he said, mate, you can be my last apprentice if you'd like. And you just come up here and I'll teach you every day. Come here and you can work for me and pay for your tuition that way. And I'll teach you how to blacksmith, mate. And he taught me that. He taught me how to work on ferrous metals and, you know, like silver and copper and gold, and taught me faceting and cabochon and timber working and leather. And he changed my life, old Ken. Yeah.
Is he still around?
He is. He's getting on, the old fella. He lives down in Braywood. Yeah. He definitely straightened me out and gave me a purpose in life for sure.
And since you've come out from Alone Australia, have you been in contact with him? How does he feel about it?
Oh, he loves it. He loves it. You know, I get the calls from him every now and then. I like keeping him up to date with things and what I'm doing and stuff. He's a busy man too, so he's always out doing something. Yeah.
Chase, I'm curious to know how your participation with Alone Season 2 went down with the Defence Force. I mean, how did you negotiate that time away? And since you've been back and since everyone's learned that you've been involved in this experience, how has that been for you? Like, have you had any jokes made at your expense, or has everyone been patting you on the back, or what's that experience been like?
For the most part, very supportive, especially now I've come back and they like what they see. So it's been great. No, the jokes that I've been copping are all in good spirit, don't you worry, but it's been pretty funny. Now that all the episodes have come back, there's half a dozen pictures of my face floating around with different quotes and things like that. Adaptability, like, you know.
You're the poster lad.
You're a meme.
With your army experience, it's something that we've seen a lot in previous series of Alone in the Northern Hemisphere, mm-hmm. is that people who come from a military background bring with them their family is the military. So it's just like it's a different kind of family.
No job gets done alone around here. You're relying on each other. We've got logistics, we've got frontline, we've got and everything in between, and you need to be able to work with one another whether you got differences or not. We got all walks of life in the army, so there was no realizations there. It's very clear that we all need each other to get along, and you know what, Australia is exactly the same. We all need each other. It doesn't matter what walk of life you're from. We all need to get along and support each other. And that is very, very important.
You've done a whole lot of things with your army family. Was this the first time you'd done something like this without that support?
Yeah. Oh, well, to this scale, absolutely. We all do our own little bouts and stuff here and there. And this was, you know, even in another country by yourself too. It was just a whole nother level.
Chase, we've got another section to this interview. It's a bit of a lightning round, like quick fire questions. Basically, quick questions, quick answers. The first question, what was the favourite of your 10 items?
My knife.
What was your biggest surprise out there?
The isolation, the segregation, absolutely.
Who or what did you miss most?
Partner.
Where did you tell your friends you were going?
I told them I was going on a hunting trip to New Zealand.
It's not a lie, really. What was your favourite pastime out there?
Sharpening my knife.
What's your favourite thing to hunt?
Deer. Also my favourite animal. They're beautiful animals.
What would you tell somebody who was thinking of applying for a loan?
Go for it. Yeah. Absolutely go for it. Become a storyteller.
Sandflies or leeches?
Oh, they both suck. That's my answer.
Would you do it again?
Absolutely, I'd do it again.
What surprised you since you got out?
Fatherhood. I've been so focused on it. Time has just flown. I can't believe it. That's all, yeah. Fatherhood.
Chase, look, thank you so much for joining us and for your insights into this. It's great to see that fatherhood is treating you very well and everything picked up with the Defence Force once you got back. So, mate, best of luck and thank you.
I really want to acknowledge your beautiful humility. You showed it on the episode and in your tap out. And I've got to say, the youngest participant on this season of Alone Australia, you show a remarkable maturity. So thanks for sharing it with us.
Wow. That is such high praise from you, Jima. Oh, my God. Thank you so much. That was... You melted me a little bit there, eh?
No. Well, I'd give you a hug if I could.
Thanks for joining us on this podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, email alonepodcast@sbs.com.au and use the hashtag AloneAustralia on socials. Follow us on your podcast app to catch all the upcoming episodes when they drop, and we'll see you after the next episode. Alone Australia, the podcast, is produced by SBS Audio, Carolyn Gates, Max Gosford, Joel Supple and Karen Okuda. Special thanks to Joseph Maxwell, ITV, Alone Australia's executive producer, Rima Daya, and of course, all the participants.